Support comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912, fsbbigfork.com, member FDIC.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, scrutiny on the Justice Department as the Ghislaine Maxwell transcripts are released and the FBI raids the home of a former national security advisor. Then Ron Elving on the week in politics. Also, the mayor of St. John, New Brunswick on the new Canadian cry of elbows up. And then Pina Palladino and Blake Mills have recorded a new album that they call That Wasn't a Dream.
When me and Blake get together, it turns into something unique, which is a word that's probably overused to describe things, but I'd like to stick with that word.
First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, August 23, 2025.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Minnesota government remains under scrutiny over high-profile fraud cases, mainly involving people posing as service providers who get reimbursements through phony billing. A company assisting government agencies describes this as a growing threat. The Minnesota Department of Human Services plans to redesign a housing stabilization program after shutting it down earlier this month. The agency said it had no choice after suspending payments to dozens of providers based upon credible allegations of fraud. Asia Brown with Forward Platform says it's not surprising to hear, noting many state and local governments rely on antiquated monitoring systems.
With the expansion and sophistication of technology, it's much easier to create fraudulent documents.
She recommends safeguards that include, quote, multi-point checks with more efficiencies. Experts note it can take a long time to build criminal cases in these situations. This year, Minnesota approved new prevention measures, but lawmakers acknowledge the need for more. State leaders also announced this year they were exploring a pilot system involving artificial intelligence, a move Brown says is needed. She says departments have to fight back with improved technology that's becoming less expensive to implement. Brown says fraud can be frustrating for taxpayers to hear, but stressed there should be a careful approach so that program recipients aren't burdened with added hoops to jump through.
There's an increase in number of American families that need vital aid, and it's essential that we really optimize the way that we're able to deliver these funds to recipients and that we also protect funds from being just redirected.
The dynamic involving tougher eligibility is playing out more so at the federal level. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act pushed through Congress by Republicans includes controversial work requirements for Medicaid. Republicans contend they'll help eliminate fraud and waste, but opponents say they target the wrong people and lead to administrative headaches. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. Minnesota's Department of Employment and Economic Development announced $3.6 million in funding to help businesses enter the state's cannabis industry as well as train workers. The three programs, Can Navigate, Can Startup, and Can Train, offer funding and technical support to start and expand cannabis businesses in Minnesota, as well as grants to workforce training organizations for cannabis job training. They were created in the 2023 legislature when lawmakers legalized adult-use cannabis in the state. White Earth Tribal and Community College will be granted $500,000 under the CanTrain program. The public is invited to learn more about Crow Wing County's long-range transportation plan at an upcoming public meeting. Chelsea Perkins gives us the details.
The County Highway Department finished the initial phase of public engagement for the plan and analyzed the feedback to identify trends and themes. More than 500 comments came in through a survey and an interactive map. The meeting will include a presentation on those themes, opportunities to provide more feedback, and talk with Crow Wing County Highway staff. The transportation plan will help identify and prioritize long-term investments focused on vehicle and pedestrian safety, road maintenance, and to prepare for future growth and change. In 2024, Crow Wing was identified as one of 10 counties in the state projected for significant population growth. It's the only one outside of the Twin Cities and Rochester metropolitan areas. The meeting is 6 to 7:30 p.m. Thursday at the Crow Wing County Land Services Building in Brainerd. Chelsea Perkins, KAXE News.
As the new school year approaches, the backpack program provided by Second Harvest Northland begins its 15th year. Beginning in 2010 as the Superior School District's Nutrition on Weekend program, it now provides weekend food to children at schools within 22 different Northeast Minnesota and Northwest Wisconsin communities, reaching more than 1,600 students each week, according to a news release. In the 15-county service region served by Second Harvest Northland, the organization says 1 in 6 children are food insecure. During the week, free and reduced-price lunches at school help children meet their nutritional needs and alleviate parental stress. But for many families, weekends present a gap in reliable access to food. The backpack program fills this gap by ensuring students head home at the end of the week with a discreet bag of nutritious, easy-to-open, easy-to-prepare food, such as fruits, vegetables, ready-to-eat meals, and cereal. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is sponsored by Woodland Bank, with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River, dedicated to serving the financial needs of the community and their customers. More info at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Busy Friday for the Justice Department. Yesterday morning, FBI agents searched the home and office of President Donald Trump's former national security advisor and now his prominent critic, John Bolton. Hours later, the department released transcripts from its recent interview with Ghislaine Maxwell, the longtime associate of convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us. Ryan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And let's begin with Ghislaine Maxwell. Remind us why the DOJ talked to her in the first place.
So Maxwell's a former girlfriend and, as you said, longtime associate of Epstein's. She's currently serving a 20-year sentence on sex trafficking and other charges for helping Epstein sexually exploit underage girls. Now, the number two official in the Trump Justice Department, the president's former personal attorney, Todd Blanche, he sat down for a two-day interview with Maxwell in Florida last month. And he did so because the DOJ is trying to tamp down the public blowback that it's faced over its handling of the Epstein files.
Anything stand out from those transcripts for you?
Well, there weren't any major revelations. Many of the famous names that have surfaced over the years in connection with Epstein do come up. But at one point, Maxwell tells Blanche that she never saw any man do anything inappropriate with a woman of any age while with Epstein. And she also said that Epstein didn't have a client list, that there's no black book, and that he didn't blackmail associates.
Now, Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein were friends for years before they had an apparent falling out. What did she say about Donald Trump?
So Maxwell told Blanche that she never saw Trump do anything improper. She said he was never in an inappropriate setting. She also said this.
And as far as I'm concerned, President Trump was always very cordial and very kind to me. And I just want to say that I admire his extraordinary achievement in becoming the president now, and I like him, and I've always liked him.
Now, her attorney says Maxwell told the truth in this interview, but there are a couple of things to bear in mind here. One is that Maxwell, as I said earlier, is serving a 20-year prison sentence. Mm-hmm. She would very much like a reduction in that sentence or a pardon. The one man who can deliver that is President Trump. The other thing is that, remember, a federal jury in New York heard evidence about Maxwell's role grooming girls for Epstein to sexually exploit, and they convicted her on that evidence.
Do you think the transcript and audio recordings are going to convince those who've doubted the department is being open about the Epstein case?
It's hard to imagine, but we'll see what effect this has. Many skeptics want to see the full Epstein files. Now, the Justice Department did send some of those files to the House Oversight Committee on Friday. That was in response to a subpoena. Now, those files aren't going to be made public right away. The committee's Republican chairman says that the panel's going to go through them to make sure that victims' identities and any child sexual abuse materials are redacted first.
Finally, Ryan, the FBI search of John Bolton's home and office. What can you tell us?
So Vice President J.D. Vance has said that this is related, at least in part, to classified documents. Now, Bolton, as you noted at the top, is a very outspoken critic of President Trump. And this search of his home and his office, those come just a couple of weeks after the Justice Department opened probes into two other very prominent, outspoken Trump critics. That's California Senator Adam Schiff and New York Attorney General Letitia James. So this is just going to deepen concerns about whether the Justice Department is using its enormous powers to pursue President Trump's promised campaign of vengeance against his perceived political enemies.
NPR's Ryan Lucas, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Trump continued his attacks on the Federal Reserve this week for not lowering interest rates. Then yesterday, the Fed chair, Jerome Powell, said a possible cut might be in the offing. We're joined now by NPR's Ron Elving. Ron, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Just the hint of that possibility sent up the stock market. Is it potentially good news for the economy?
Well, a lot of investors surely think so, or at least they think a lot of other investors will think so, and stock prices will therefore rise. And they certainly spiked yesterday. But it's good to remember that Powell was teasing a possible rate cut because he says he sees potential weakness in the economy, a softer labor market, among other things. He also worried out loud about stubborn inflation and the impact of tariffs. But he does not want his tight money policy to tip the economy into recession. So much depends on what the numbers say in September. If Powell sees the tariffs driving up inflation more than he expected, he could pull back on the rate cut. But if he likes the trends in a month, he can make a modest cut and hint at more to come. A rate cut of any size would be a trophy for Trump and his high-pressure style of governing.
Republican lawmakers in Texas have voted to redraw congressional maps to try to boost the party's electoral odds. Democrats in California have retaliated, starting down that same kind of path. Now Missouri, Indiana, other states contemplating the same. Is there a gerrymandering arms race going on?
Oh, it's on. Trump is letting the red states know he expects them to report for duty. He wants them to lay claim to some swing district seats in the House that in a midterm year, like next year, might well vote against the party in the White House. And if it's an arms race, the Republicans are better armed. There are more states where they control the governorship and the legislature. So if it's going to be an all-out war with everybody pushing super-partisan mapping to the max, the likely winners, at least in the short run, would be Republicans. The losers, once again, are the voters in all the districts where they thought they'd be able to cast a meaningful vote for Congress in a competitive race. It's obviously not good for democracy. It's an abuse of power, but it's been practiced by both parties back to the 1700s. It was greatly enhanced, of course, by modern computing and contemporary data applications, so we see the newest tech serving the oldest of political motives.
Ron, the week began with hopes for peace between Russia and Ukraine. Trump has now sent a new two-week deadline. Closer to any kind of agreement, do you think?
One hates to say no. After all the effort that's been made, after all the show of unity by the European allies, but it's hard to see what's brought peace any closer this month, or might do so in Trump's latest two-week window. Trump dropped his demand for a ceasefire as a precondition for a deal. Putin gave up. Well, Putin gave up what? He has yet to commit even to a meeting with Ukrainian President Zelensky. Putin continues to bomb Ukraine's cities and the people who live there. He continues to insist that Ukraine give up land seized by the Russian army and maybe more besides. And where is Trump in all this? It seems clear that he does want peace to happen for the combatants and for his own legacy. But do the Russians? Trump needs a tool or a tactic to turn Putin around, and unless he's willing to commit U.S. forces, he has to fall back on more economic sanctions. And when he's threatened tougher economic measures of late, he's backed off again. So the present moment has to be very discouraging for Ukraine and its defenders.
District of Columbia, the troop deployment's going into its third week. The president says he'll ask Congress for more money for upgrades in the city, says it'll be maxed out in terms of beauty. Is this going to happen in other cities?
Well, we're not sure yet it's going to happen in D.C., for starters. But if it does, it will surely tempt Trump to take on the larger constitutional and political problems of taking over cities that are in states that are not as subject to federal orders as D.C. This city is a unique situation. As for maxing out on beauty, perhaps the model here would be the new Oval Office. This may be the ultimate case of beauty being in the eye of the beholder.
NPR's Ron Elving, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
A question hung over this week's meeting between President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. What would President Zelensky wear to the Oval Office? Last February, Ukraine's president wore a black Henley shirt to the White House, no jacket, keeping the bunker chic look he's maintained since the 2022 Russian invasion. But the meeting got combative. President Trump chastised President Zelensky as ungrateful for U.S. support. A reporter for a right-wing cable channel called out, "Why don't you wear a suit? You're at the highest level in this country's office and you refuse to wear a suit. Do you own a suit?" President Trump ended the meeting and said of the Ukrainian president on social media, he disrespected the United States of America in its cherished Oval Office. This week, President Zelensky changed his look. He wore a black canvas blazer over a black collared shirt buttoned at the top, still no tie, but his solemn clothing seemed to proclaim, "Let's have a serious conversation." Even the reporter who panned his February wardrobe told Zelensky he looked fabulous. President Trump added, "I said the same thing." President Zelensky told the reporter, "And you're in the same suit. You see, I changed. You have not." Yes, men can get weary of being judged by the cut of their clothes, not the cut of their jibs. Sam Shuby, who covered the fashion aspect of the Oval Office meeting for the Wall Street Journal, told us, "I'm not sure there's such a thing as a non-political outfit. Everything politicians wear, no matter how bland, sends a message. Winston Churchill famously wore an air raid suit when he visited the White House in December 1941, just after the United States had been attacked at Pearl Harbor. It reminded Americans that Britons were being bombed in their homes, and Europe faced a life-or-death crisis. Sam Shuby says President Zelensky has been working with a Ukrainian designer so that his clothing and public appearances blends his wartime style with something a bit more formal. He looks like he's dressing not just for battle, but high-stakes endgame diplomacy. Zelensky called this week's White House visit the best one yet. The clothes may not make the man, but they might help make for a better meeting. And you're listening to NPR News.
Good morning. Thank you for listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXE. It is 7:18. I'm Jennifer Barr. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets 6 p.m. Monday, August 25th at KBXC in Bemidji. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxc.org. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month, and the board's meeting schedule is available at kaxc.org. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week, we'll hear about a pop-up art show that happened last week, Words as Buried Seeds. We'll hear from the organizers and others about that scene, coming up at 9 o'clock and again Sunday at 5. Heroes Heart Rescue has an adoption event today at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. Visit with adoptable dogs and cats from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Thanks for listening to KAXE.
Well, I've got two brothers and they're in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled and Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, You need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
For NPR comes from this station and from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in three new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. From Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney says his country will lift many of the retaliatory tariffs placed on U.S. goods starting September 1. Relations between the two countries have been severely strained by President Trump's decision to slap high tariffs on Canadian goods and repeated threats to make Canada the 51st state, even if he has no legal authority to do so. Now a movement known as Elbows Up is calling on Canadians to reassess relations with the U.S., showing that the nation is strong, independent, and not for sale. Donna Node Reardon is the mayor of St. John, New Brunswick, just northeast of Maine. She joins us now. Mayor Reardon, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I think of Elbows Up as a hockey term, right?
Exactly.
What's it mean now?
It means like, let's stick together, let's be supportive of each other, let's not back down on, you know, some of the things that are important to us as a country. So that's what it sort of means to Canadians today, right now.
You have said, I gather, that it's time for Canada to break up with the U.S. and move on. But we're neighbors. We share so much.
I agree. We share so much. We have shared an amazing relationship since the Second World War. We have a border that we are both comfortable crossing and we're never hassled or harassed. We've got, you know, people here in Canada that have relatives just on the other side of the border. I'm only an hour to the U.S. border, to Calais, Maine. So we've had a very reciprocal relationship for a long time.
But. Yeah, what's happened now?
Well, you have a new president down there who's sort of changing the rules of engagement for us. And it's all about, tariffs. And we feel like we're being punished and we don't really understand or know why we're being punished. And we don't know what the punishment is from one day to the next. It has changed and it's changing again. I hear if, you know, retaliatory tariffs are removed, then maybe we can talk and we put retaliatory tariffs on because we couldn't talk before, you know, so it creates so much uncertainty for Canadians. A lot of Canadians have chosen to stay home and try to explore our own country, spend our money here.
What difference have the tariffs made in St. John?
It's created a lot of instability. And with St. John, we have the highest gross domestic product per capita. Now, we're not large, but we have a gross domestic product of $81,000 per capita here in St. John. And in New Brunswick, there are three major cities. Moncton and Fredericton would be the other two. And their GDP is like $2,000 and $4,000 per capita each. So we are apparently the highest impacted city in the country. We have oil refinery here, largest oil refinery in the country. We have pulp and paper here. We have aquaculture here. We have a port here. Now, a lot of the port's partners would be east of here. So it would be, you know, across the Atlantic Ocean. So those relationships have already been established. So for us, like we're saying, like maybe we need to look to strengthen those relationships.
How do you feel personally when President Trump says that Canada should be the 51st state?
That's not my cup of tea. Listen, I love being a partner with the U.S. But, you know, we don't want to be part of the U.S.
Do you have any particular hopes for the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement? It's due for review next year.
It's been, in an interesting way, it's been a gift for Canada, because we have had trade barriers between our provinces, you know, that we've never even thought about, because we've had so much interaction with the U.S. that we've never really looked at this border system that we have from province to province to province. And what this did was it forced all of the premiers to work together and to come up with some solutions. So if we could continue with that and they could continue to break down the barriers between our provinces and we could get back on track with the U.S., it would be amazing.
The mayor of St. John, New Brunswick, Donna Node Reardon, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Scott. My pleasure.
And now we're going on a bear hunt. And let's try that again, together this time. We're going on a bear hunt.
We're going to catch a big one. What a beautiful day. We're not scared. Uh-oh.
Ah, that's more like it. It's Michael Rosen reading from his children's book about a family going on a bear hunt and encountering many obstacles along the way.
Grass. Long, wavy grass. We can't go over it, we can't go under it. Oh no, we got to go through it. Swishy, 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 swishy. Over to you, Helen.
And this is the illustrator, Helen Oxenberry.
We're going on a bear hunt. We're going to catch a big one. What a beautiful day. And we're not scared. Uh-oh, a forest, a big dark forest. We can't go over it, and we can't go under it. Oh no, we've got to go through it. Stumble, trip, stumble, trip, stumble, trip.
That was no dress rehearsal, no rehearsal of any kind. Total improv world premiere you got there.
Oh, God.
We're Going on a Bear Hunt has sold more than 4 million copies since it was published in 1989. Today, Michael Rosen and Helen Oxenberry are both world-renowned for their work writing and illustrating books for children. They live a couple miles apart in London and only bump into each other occasionally. So, for our series, Picture This, we invited them to read and reflect on their first picture book together. Rosen said he first heard Bear Hunt as a folk song and he would perform it at shows for children.
The director of Walker Books here in the UK, he saw my show and he said, oh, I like that thing that you did at the end of your show. That would make a great picture book. I said, well, you should write it down. He said, no, you write it down. I said, you write it down. He said, you write it down. So we had a little bit of an argument as to who was going to write it down. And then when I went to write it down, I make noises at the different obstacles that the family face. So when we go through the mud, I'd go... and when we go through the water, I go... Well, it's quite hard to write those things down, so I had to think of words for those. And then also in the version that I knew, there weren't descriptions of the places, so I had to do things like a deep, cold river. And then it was over to Helen.
My vision of it was very different from Michael's, but Michael did have a vision, which was what, Michael?
I thought that it could be a bit like Carnival. There could be all sorts of different characters, giants and monsters and kings and queens, and they'd all be walking after a guy in a bear suit. I think Helen, when I said this to Helen, she looked at me with a slightly strange quizzical look and she said,
Yes, did completely the opposite. I just made it a family who went on a bear hunt. Everybody thinks that the older boy is the father, but actually I didn't want an adult in this adventure. I think children like the idea that they go on adventures without parents and adults.
In the family, we also have a dog who's absolutely crucial to it for young children. I mean, I've watched young children with the book and they follow the dog through the book. Their little fingers, they point at it. And
yes.
I've seen them going, where's the dog? Where's the dog?
Yes.
So you've got these different stories that are there for the children to find in the page.
Yes. Well, I always include my dog of that time.
Oh, was it your dog, was it?
Yes, he was.
Oh.
What Bear Hunt has, I think, is a beginning, a middle, and an end. You have to grab a child's attention. With a Bear Hunt, you get their attention because they're going on an adventure, and then it gets really quite scary. Uh-oh, a cave. A narrow, gloomy cave. We can't go over it and we can't go under it. Oh, no, we've got to go through it. And then, extremely scary tip-toe. When they meet the bear.
Tiptoe. Tiptoe, what's that?
One shiny, wet nose.
Two big, furry ears.
Two big, goggly eyes.
It's a bear!
When they're out there, they're either being exultant or brave. You know, it's quite scary when they're in the snowstorm, I always think.
Yes, that's right, yes. What I think probably attracted me mostly to this story is the variety of landscapes. The text dictates what the medium is that I use. Bear Hunt, I chose watercolour because it's a very English way of painting landscapes.
They're beautiful landscapes, they're wonderful. That picture of the family running through down a hill through the grass with poppies and other wild flowers in. It's, you know, when you get to the cave, this is full of Gothic wonder, I think.
But also there's another side to this story, which is the family considering how they're going to overcome these obstacles. And I chose to make that a very separate thing from the actual physical thing of them getting through the landscape by doing it in sepia, just two colours. And it sort of represented the waiting and the thinking of how they're going to do it. And then when they decided, the colour came naturally then.
When I came to see Helen's illustrations of a family on holiday, as it seemed to me, I was baffled and wondered why the family didn't seem very equipped to go bear hunting, because I don't have much imagination. The idea that hides behind, I think, Helen's pictures is, of course, this wonderful family have probably, possibly, let's hold it as a little ambiguous moment, imagining that there's a bear. And if you want to, you can say that the thinking bits are real and the colour bits are imagined or something like that.
Yes, you're not quite sure if it was all true or not.
No, so it's a lovely ambiguity about it, and I think sometimes we underestimate the fact that we can give children ambiguities, and that's fascinating for them. We can make mysteries for young children, and that's great.
And it all ends well.
Into the bedroom.
Into bed, under the covers.
We're not going on a bear hunt again. Except we often do, don't we? Yes.
Every day.
That might be how we're going on a bear hunt ends, but it is not where the story of Michael Rosen and Helen Oxenberry ends, because 36 years after their first book together, they've now got a second children's book.
Yes.
Yes. So that is Oh Dear, Look What I Got by Michael Rosen and Helen Oxenberry.
I liked it because it was different and would suggest that I could do slightly different illustrations, which I have done. It's just the characters, really, and absolutely no background at all.
And I will read you just a little bit so you get an idea of what the rhythm. So the opening is, I went to the shop to get me a carrot. Oh dear, they gave me... And then you turn over the page, thanks to Helen, and what is it? A parrot! Oh dear, look what I got. Do I want that? No, I do not. So that's the verse structure. We'll give you one more time for another one. I went to the shop to get me a hat. Oh dear, they gave me a cat. Oh dear, look what I got. Do I want that? No, I do not. There you go. Oh dear, look what I got. I've got a book.
I read it to my grandchildren. Now, if you say to them, would you like some more broccoli on your plate? They say, do I want that? No, I do not.
That's right. So I've armed children with a riposte. That's the danger of giving children voices in books. They use them against us
they
adults.
Do, don't they? Yes.
Scandalous. We shouldn't be in this business, really, should we? No.
Dear, Look What I Got, with words by Michael Rosen, pictures by Helen Oxenberry, is out September 2nd. Our series, Picture This, is produced by Samantha Balaban. And for more conversations like this one, you can head to npr.org/picturethis.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. You may be familiar with the Little Free Libraries, the take-a-book, leave-a-book exchanges. But in Portland, Oregon, that idea has expanded to include mug swaps, trinket exchanges, mini art galleries. There's even a map to find it all. OPB's Crystal Liguori reports.
It's a sunny summer day in southeast Portland, and six-year-old Louie and his mom, Stephanie O'Leary, are inspecting a group of plastic dinosaurs positioned on the fence line of a yard.
This is my second favorite dinosaur.
Yeah? What kind of dinosaur is that?
I forgot.
The Dino Exchange is just one of the pieces of Sidewalk Joy in the yard of artist Rachel Harms Millant. Sidewalk Joy is just what it sounds like. Yard installations created to bring joy. She started making her own after seeing similar creative offerings in other people's yards.
Coming across these installations was really inspiring for me. My kids loved it, obviously. We would like squeal with delight.
Now her yard has nearly a dozen installations, like a mug swap, a teeny tiny library where the miniature books are kept behind a silver door no bigger than a light switch cover, and a hedgehog adoption station.
So it's actually just the, you know, the puff on a pussy willow branch.
Yeah.
If you can, you can draw a little face and a little body on it, and then you got a little tiny hedgehog.
As a self-proclaimed steward of Sidewalk Joy, Harms Millant didn't just want people to see the installations in her yard.
I would just see someone come by and start telling them about the other spaces in town that they might get a kick out of. And then somebody finally suggested, you know, there should be a map of spaces like this.
So along with another artist, she started compiling all the locations she could find, creating the PDX Sidewalk Joy map in 2023. Today, the online map has over 100 different locations. At one, you'll find 10 tiny hand crank music boxes mounted along a fence. At another, a vintage candy machine dispenses 50-cent prizes, like temporary tattoos, a light-up jelly ring, rock facts, or a daily fortune.
Oh, something fell down.
Then there's the wishing tree, which is covered in palm-sized note cards scrawled with people's wishes. Some of the cards are weathered, smeared, and unreadable, while others seem written that day.
I wish to continue with school without having to worry about money problems. This person's wish just says to make more art. I wish for the ability to feel love again. Oof.
The map just gives you the cross streets, not exact addresses. So sometimes finding things is a challenge. Like Jurassic Blooms, a set of little plastic dinosaur vases that hold flower bouquets.
Might be out of luck. I found it. I found it. Oh, this is part of the joy, I think. The hunt is part of the joy.
Rachel Harms Millant says people from all over the world have used the Sidewalk Joy map.
I kept getting messages from people who were either visiting from far away, like visitors from Japan, Australia, stuff like that, coming to see the scene we had here, or people messaging me saying, I created something like this based on what I heard about in Portland.
So last summer, she made a worldwide map so people all over the globe can share in their community's creativity. For NPR News, I'm Crystal Liguori in Portland.
This is NPR News.
It's 7:39. Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from First National Bank Bemidji, helping local families and businesses reach their financial goals. First National Bank Bemidji, better together, member FDIC. We also thank the Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. You can pay nothing to get that old or damaged car towed away, even if it doesn't run. Your donation of a car, boat, or other vehicle is tax deductible. You can save time and money while defending the KAXE programs you love. Call 855-277-2346 for details. The Virginia Public Library has a used book sale going on from 9 to 1 today at the Iron Trail Motors Event Center. Let us know what's going on in your community. Email us, psa@kaxe.org.
I'm Giles Snyder with these headlines. Lyle Menendez has been denied parole. The decision in California came a day after his younger brother Eric was blocked from being freed. The two have spent more than 30 years in prison for murdering their parents in 1989, both claimed abuse by their father. A recall election is being held in Taiwan today. Voters are deciding whether to dismiss 7 members of the opposition. It's an attempt to restore control by the Democratic Progressive Party, which lost its majority last year. Voters are also deciding a referendum on nuclear power. And in South Williamsport, Pennsylvania, the right to play for the Little League World Series Championship is on the line today. The winners of the U.S. and international brackets will play for the title tomorrow. I'm Joel Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person, with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at viking.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. 20 years ago, Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans. And in the wake of the storm, charter schools replaced traditional public schools in a way that had not been seen before. Many of those charter schools promoted the idea that every student should go to college. Now, at a time when polls show many Americans question the value of a college degree, reporter Sarah Carr looks back at the successes and failures of the College for All movement.
There was one charter school operator after Katrina that epitomized the College for All push in New Orleans. They even had an anthem for it. KIPP, which stands for the Knowledge is Power program, is a national charter school network. In New Orleans, it served mostly low-income Black students, and it kept a relentless eye on the same prize, college.
Read, babe, read. You gotta read, babe, read.
Geraldine Stewart was 9 years old when Katrina hit. Afterwards, she ended up at KIPP schools.
KIPP really made it a point to like college, 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 college. That's what we want. We want college, 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 college.
And in 2014, she went, but she left partway through her second semester, far from a degree.
Financially, I'm not where I want to be, and it bothers me because I know I could have been somewhere, you know, in a different situation.
She recently tried to enroll in a cosmetology program, a longtime dream, but there was something holding her back, a decade-old student loan. A $1,200 balance lingers. She supported her kids through jobs at the airport, Walmart, and now Target. But as hard as she works, clearing the balance hasn't been easy.
Now, my struggle is being 28 with 3 kids and not knowing what's my purpose.
Today, the earliest graduates of those college-focused high schools are in their late 20s or early 30s. And there's some solid data on how things went for them after charters came to town.
Test scores, high school graduation rates, college going, everything improved. And everything improved a lot.
Education researcher Doug Harris says more students started college.
We're almost at the top of the state at this point in college going rates, which is remarkable.
The problem is many students didn't stay in college. Harris, who works at Tulane University, looked at college persistence at the time Gerald Lynn Stewart's cohort would have been enrolled. In a study, his team found that before Katrina, about 1 in 6 New Orleans students didn't make it past their first semester. And more than a decade later, in 2016, that figure had barely changed.
That's something that really needs to be focused in on, is what is happening once students actually get to college that's preventing them from graduating.
Vincent Rossmeyer also studies New Orleans schools at Tulane. In a school system that's mostly Black and lower income, he says, students can find themselves overwhelmed at college by personal and financial strains their more affluent peers rarely encounter.
20 years post-Katrina, that is something that I'm still struck by, that, you know, education can't solve for poverty in and of itself.
But back in the 2000s, when Gerald and Stewart started attending KIPP schools, there was a lot of optimism and some naivete that those challenges could be overcome, that there was no need for a plan B. At the time, Stewart felt pretty ambivalent about college. But eventually, she says, she bought into KIPP's messaging.
It's what we wanted, as us kids wanted to hear.
After she graduated from high school in 2014, Stewart enrolled at Dillard University, a private, historically Black college in the heart of New Orleans. She juggled school with a nearly full-time job at Waffle House.
I was so much focused on financially being able to stay at this college, because Dillard isn't a cheap school.
Stewart didn't want to be a financial burden on her mother. She had a scholarship and a small loan, but it remained a hustle.
I had to buy a lab coat for biology class, and I had to have money for food to eat, because you gotta eat.
She hit a breaking point during her second semester and withdrew from Dillard to focus on earning money.
Like, I gave up on myself, pretty much. I really did. I gave up on myself.
Other classmates from KIPP also enrolled with Stewart at Dillard and struggled with money and family obligations. One of her classmates told NPR he remembers starting with a big group of KIPP alums, but over the years, most withdrew. Things would get a little better for KIPP graduates at Dillard over the next couple of years. The charter network wasn't able to provide college completion numbers for its graduates in New Orleans, but it acknowledges that setting students up to finish college remains a big challenge.
Persistence is the struggle.
KIPP New Orleans CEO Rhonda Khalifi-Aloise says KIPP remains committed to the idea that college is the surest path out of poverty. But the organization has mellowed when it comes to college for all.
We absolutely believe that all students should have the opportunity to go to college if they want to.
If they want to. Their high schools have prioritized individual college and career counseling, and they've started to offer a little more access to technical fields, like cosmetology.
It really is a both and.
Gerald Lynn Stewart's family has remained loyal to KIPP. And for the most part, Stewart says she likes the way the organization is changing.
1, 2, 3, all eyes on me. One, two, eyes on you.
20 years after Katrina, her oldest kids are KIPP students themselves.
My name is Harmony.
And Harlem.
This year, Harmony is starting third grade. Harlem is in first. At school, their mother says they're exposed to all kinds of trades and occupations, from doctors to firefighters.
I wish they drilled what they're doing now to those kids. To us, because I feel like we probably would have been better off.
Harmony has many career aspirations.
I might be a teacher or a doctor, but my mom wants me to be an artist because I know how to draw very well.
I want her to experience every little thing she possibly can. Like, she's very great. Like, she's amazing.
But what's most important to Stewart is that her daughter has opportunities of all kinds, college or not, and never feels trapped by someone else's vision of who she should be in this world. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Carr in New Orleans.
And WWNO reporter Aubrey Uhas also contributed to this story. Oliver is an artist on the brink of celebrity in the new movie Lurker. He meets an obsessive fan, Matthew, at a clothing store, and the seemingly chance encounter turns into something more. Matthew slowly worms his way into Oliver's life, pushing others aside and going to extreme lengths to stay near the limelight.
Men are so jealous of each other, and so a lot of what they do is about sort of jockeying for position, and sort of the way that they hide those ambitions can be very funny to me.
Tomorrow on Weekend Edition Sunday with Aisha, the director Alex Russell, and what he calls a mean girl story about men. You can tune in on your radio, your smartphone, or ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Bass player Pino Palladino has left an indelible mark on pop music over the past four decades, recording with artists from Elton John and Eric Clapton to Adele and D'Angelo. Blake Mills is a multi-instrumentalist and one of the most sought-after producers in the music business. They have teamed up for their second album, That Wasn't a Dream. Pino Palladino and Blake Mills join us now. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure.
Pino Palladino, we think of you as rock, pop, R&B. This album isn't exactly any of those.
Yeah, I'm known for playing on all sorts of different records and styles of music. When me and Blake get together, it turns into something unique, which is a word that's probably overused to describe things, but I'd like to stick with that word. I don't know where you would put it genre-wise, and I don't particularly want to.
That makes sense. How did you guys meet and become collaborators? I don't think I know that story.
Well, I was producing a John Legend record around 2016, and one of the fundamental concepts on the album was to use a rhythm section, a live rhythm section, for every track on the record. And there was never any other option in my mind than Pino Palladino and Chris Dave. So we reached out to see if they were available, and they were. That was the first time Pino and I met. Somewhere on that session, he mentioned that he was working on some solo material. And if I had a day to come down and play on something, how much fun that would be. And that day just turned into 2 years of working on his music.
To work together, what's the artistic process?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of composition, I mean, it'll usually be either me or Blake coming in with an idea that may not be finished, and we'll sort of, for instance, if I take an example like the first tune on the album, Contour. I had the first part of that song that I'd written on an acoustic guitar, a non-strung guitar, and I played what I had to Blake. I kind of reached a wall in terms of I didn't know where to go next on it to complete the piece, and Blake heard something immediately, like a chord change and a development of the melody. It's very experimental when we're actually recording and trying different instruments and different sounds.
When we are working out a song or a part or something like that, and it's just the two of us, and we're playing without a drummer, there's still such a sense of rhythm and more specifically a type of pocket with the rhythm that it feels like there's an imaginary ensemble playing with us. And I just kind of lose myself and forget that I'm just playing with one other person and go into this trance of rhythm.
P- Pino Palladino, there are some moments on this album that feel like you've worked it out in advance. Others sound like you're exploring. Let's, for example, listen to Taka. What can you tell us about this?
I came up with that bass line and pretty much that melodic idea, just sort of vibing, really, on my own. I love African music, West African music specifically, and that was, you know, the inspiration from listening to a lot of that music and kind of internalizing it.
There is a new instrument that appears on this album, I gather.
There is.
Tell us about this instrument, because I gather you commissioned a prototype.
Yeah, it was... for a little while, I was working with a device called an Ebo. That's been around for, I think, like 40 years or something. But it's basically just for a guitarist, you hold it in place of a pick and it resonates the string kind of like a bow would on a violin or a cello or bass or something. So you have infinite sustain and you can swell into a note like a vocalist or a wind instrument. And so I was using that, but there's limitations to it. It's not very easy to play on more than one string. And as I ran up against some of those limitations, I chanced across a fella on Instagram who was building these guitars that basically just takes that concept and spreads it across the whole six strings of a guitar. So it's not necessarily new technology, but the implementation of it on a guitar that doesn't have frets and that is in a specific tuning and has certain kinds of pickups. There were things that I knew that I wanted based on some instruments that I had at the studio. His name is Duncan Price, and he put this guitar together and sent it over to me. Until I come up with a better name for it, it's just we've been referring to it as the something like fretless baritone sustainer guitar. I don't know. It's a little clunky. We're working on it.
Oh, that'll never sell.
No. Until we can come up with something that'll fit on a lapel pin, I think we're trying to keep it still in a prototype phase.
Pino Palladino and Blake Mills, their new album. The title is That Wasn't a Dream, and it's out now. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's just before 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You can listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. We'll also hear the Up North Report, local news from our region. 9 o'clock, Stay Human, a mix of story and song hosted by Michael Goldberg. And 10 o'clock, Corey Campbell, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets 6 p.m. Monday, August 25th at KBXE in Bemidji. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month.